Welcome to New Books in American Studies. I'm your host, Michael Amico. And today, we're joined by Russell Shorto, author of the new book, Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom, just out from Norton. Revolution Song is a history of many revolutions, kaleidoscopic turns through six individual stories. And with each turn, these stories continuously reemerge and recolor the text. There is Corn Planter, a leader of the Senecan Indians, and George Germain, who would lead the British's war strategy during the American Revolution. Margaret Moncrief Coughlin, the daughter of a British major. Then there's the always worried and weary George Washington. And here's Venture Smith, an African slave who eventually purchased his freedom in Connecticut. And finally, Abraham Yates, the self-taught rabble-rouser from Albany who helped shape the politics of New York and the country. These six stories together turn to make one revolution. Russell Shorto is a prize-winning historian whose previous work includes Amsterdam, A History of the World's Most Liberal City, and The Island at the Center of the World, the epic story of Dutch Manhattan and the founding colony that shaped America. From 2008 to 2013, Russell was director of the John Adams Institute in Amsterdam, and he is currently a senior scholar at the New Netherland Institute, as well as a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. His books have been published in 14 languages. Russell Shorto, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
So there have been many, many histories of the revolution, and I'm wondering what brought you to write another one. Of course, what distinguishes it for me is that you're focusing on these individual lives as they are lived on the ground. And in the subtitle of the book is the word freedom. And so you're interested in that in some way, but not as purely an intellectual historian, but trying to capture something of that lived experience. So how did you arrive at that approach for this book?
I'm glad you see it that way, because that's what I had in mind from the beginning years ago when I came up with this idea. I did not set out thinking the world needs another book about the American Revolution. It was really that I write narrative history, which to me is storytelling about people in their time and place. And I was conscious of the fact that most books about the period tend to be about the men in the powdered wigs, the leaders, the elite. And I thought, what if it was possible for me to write a book that wove together the stories of a handful of lives from birth to death, so that we saw all of these people come of age and evolve and grapple with this thing, the American Revolution, and then grapple with the aftermath of it. People from different walks of life. I knew I wanted at least one woman. I knew I had to have a slave in there. And it turned out to be a challenge. And I spent about 2 years sort of auditioning people for roles in the book. And because I wasn't sure that I could find people with these different backgrounds whose lives were fleshed out in documentary source material well enough, because those men in the powdered wigs tended to have lots of letters and other documentary evidence of their lives. But especially for someone like a slave or a Native American, not so much. So it took about 2 years and going through, 150, maybe 200 different possible lives to include before I assembled a group of people who I thought, this gives me a range. It's not a scientific kind of overview of all of the major representative groups or anything like that. But I came up with six people, and it was important to me also that I find people for whom there were overlaps. I wanted the book to read as one story, as one narrative, not as, discrete chapters. So that was part of the challenge. And I ended up finding people who have what to me felt like enough linkages to make it read as one whole.
That's so interesting. Obviously, there are connections plot-wise that some of these people come into contact with each other or with someone who was with the other person. And so it's a nice feeling for the reader. But in many ways, the largest connections were the emotional dynamics for each quote-unquote character or historical subject. Emotional dynamics that sort of cut across time and space, even into our present. And for me is the reason that the narrative is so easy to identify with, that particular vocabularies change, but there are these common urges for connection with other people, for the defense of one's sense of self that feels damaged. And so I'm wondering, how did those sort of emotional dynamics emerge as you were choosing these people and then choosing the moments in which to through which to write this?
Yeah, I know from, this is my sixth book, so I know from experience that once you get into a subject, serendipity emerges. I mean, you will see things that you didn't know were there from the outset. And there were these sort of thematic connections between the different subjects who that jumped out at me once I was really immersed in the material. And as you were suggesting, when you're writing, I think one aspect of writing all of these from birth to death is that as you're weaving from back and forth from one to the other, you see natural life connections. The childhoods overlap in sometimes standard obvious ways and sometimes in kind of surprising ways, so that George Washington and Venture Smith, who was born Brotir Furo in Africa and then captured and sold into slavery, both of them were raised with a different but really quite overlapping kind of honor code or honor culture. And Venture Smith, as Brotir Furo, was the son of a local prince. And he had a certain way of understanding what life was and what was expected of him. And it was kind of similar to George Washington's. And it turns out both of them lost their fathers at about the same age. And in different, very different ways, both had expectations for their future completely altered. So things like that, as people get older and struggle with marriage and children and those kinds of issues, then there are overlaps as well.
Yeah, it did strike me, and I know you mentioned this in the book, that at least two characters, maybe three or four, you could argue are essentially sort of fatherless, or that the father is not present in a way that, is certainly absent in a way that is problematically present for a lot of these characters. But instead of saying, you know, what this necessarily meant for them, you are interested in showing the kind of socio-psychic implications through these wonderfully stark portraits of recognition that the characters, that the historical subjects go through, such as when young Margaret is over studying in Britain, and she realizes that her father comes to visit her and then leaves, and that she realizes that she both adores and hates her father, you say, through these sort of comings and goings. And are those just dynamics that emerged as you were putting these stories together, or did you go out in terms of trying to find sort of moments of recognition like that to drive the plot forward?
No, those things just happened as I was going through it. And as I say, I think they emerged because there are certain life experiences that not every single person, but many people tend to share. And as you say, it turned out that there were several of the people whose life and whose early life is really shaped by their relationship with their father or the absence of their father, their father's death. Two of them, their father dies when they're 10 or 11. One corn planter, the Seneca, his mother was an important Seneca woman. His father was kind of a ne'er-do-well rum trader, a white man from upstate New York, who, you know, spends a little time in the village and then leaves. And so he's this absent figure in his life. And corn planter feels that absence enough that when he's old enough, he walks about 300 miles to confront this man and say, you know, who are you? Why are you not in my life? And you know, I certainly couldn't have planned for things like that. But as I'm working through the material, you see those things happen, and then you realize, oh, there are these interesting connections. So I sort of highlight that a bit, but I'm not, you know, I'm trying not to sort of bang you over the head with it to say, look, see, these people are going through similar things. I'm just hoping that as a reader, you're feeling those kinds of connections.
Yeah, I certainly felt them. And I think it's important to highlight because many historians, well, I would say more academic historians or people ensconced in the academy don't necessarily look for those things or know how to find them. And so I think it's important to recognize the power of the emotional dynamics. I was actually mesmerized by Kornplanter's desire, need really to sort of find his father, see his father, reunite with his father. And there's that wonderful moment later on where he's leading a raid, and he raids the town in which his father is living and captures his father. And then, you know, a little bit later, turns to him and tries to sort of ask if he knows who he is, whether he knows that this is his son. And again, it's something that just cuts right into the present. So people might be wondering then, with all these little examples and just us talking about the emotional dynamics, what does this have to do with the revolution? And what were they fighting for, or how did they articulate what they were fighting for, these people, in many different ways? And what that has to do with, you know, these feelings that you're trying to capture. So what is the relationship between those dynamics and the ideas of the time, so to speak?
Yeah, well, the book is about freedom, which is, I guess you would say, what any book about the American Revolution is going to concern itself with. But I approach it, I stay with the people in their lives. And I guess I am assuming in the book a certain knowledge, maybe not detailed knowledge about the events of the period, but I assume that the reader has an idea in mind of what the era of the American Revolution was. So I don't feel the need to, this isn't a textbook, and I'm not trying to cover every battle, that sort of thing. I'm really staying with these people, and you are getting an alternate view because you're so focused on different arenas, like a slave's view, a teenage girl's view. But since one of the people is George Washington, when we're with him, we're on more or less familiar territory. So there is that kind of familiar sense of the revolution. And the freedom theme plays out. My expertise really is in the world of the 1600s, the intellectual world in Europe, when the Dutch Enlightenment spawned the later European Enlightenment and American Enlightenment. And at that moment, starting then in the 1620s and 1630s, you get this new focus on people looking into microscopes and telescopes and gathering information and seeing the world and understanding that knowledge is really something that every human being can acquire. It doesn't come from received wisdom. And therefore, they come up with this notion that every human being is equally valuable. And therefore, this notion of freedom starts to take hold. And going back, starting at that period, I really came at the revolution from a century before, and seeing this freedom wave build and grow. And it's a much bigger thing, really, than what we associate, the way we associate freedom with the American Revolution. What the revolutionaries did was take this force that was underway and channel it or focus one part of it, this notion of political freedom. But all kinds of freedoms were being talked about. As early as the 1640s in Europe, people were arguing that girls had just as much right to education as boys, for example. Slavery was being debated and considered an immoral institution a century before the revolution was fought. So all of these things were in the air, and therefore these people in their different backgrounds and different walks of life were struggling with different types of freedom, which overlapped with one another. And I try to let that play in their lives without sort of stepping out and telling you, the reader, see, pay attention to this. I would like the reader to just feel that.
Right. And you also introduce these ideas, you know, from the bottom up, so to speak, or through their discovery by these historical subjects. So even though you mention a few times these Enlightenment individuals, Descartes and Hobbes and other philosophers, and of course their ideas of freedom and all sorts of political philosophy has been written about, you know, ad nauseum, and how we misunderstand and we can re-understand. But what I take from your narrative, again, is that it, what's going on in this moment is that people had a new language to articulate their own freedom. And you show in some episodes the kind of grasping for that language and the acquisition of that language. So I'm thinking of when Abraham Yates in Albany does his, there's a moment where he's doing his own philosophical reading and education. And you can, based on everything that comes before that in the story, I felt it as not you saying, these were the ideas of the time, and here's an example, Abraham Yates. But it's that these ideas become, in the moment, as he's reading, and as we're reading the text, a way for him to assert a sense of self that has felt in many ways sort of blighted and bested in the past. And it's that feeling of finding a language to assert a more cohesive self against what he feels as someone who was maybe pushed aside. It's that feeling of finding that language that is the driver of the story here.
Yeah, I tried to, as you say, we're dealing with issues that go back to the sort of philosophical currents of a century or more before. But they do, I mean, in that age, in that moment, people felt these things in their lives, and not just in the way that we associate with the revolution, but in the case of Yeats, he was one of the first people in America to pick up the writings of John Locke and apply them. This is in the 1750s during the French and Indian War, and apply them to the rights and the needs of British subjects in America. And Margaret Moncrief, when she, it would be anachronistic to talk about, you know, a woman's movement in the 1770s, but there was a cutting edge of that. And it was the notion of forced marriage. And people at the time the revolution was breaking out, were writing articles and writing plays about, based on this notion that a woman ought not to be forced to marry against her will. And that's exactly what happens to her. Her father forces her to, he's a British officer, and he forces her to marry another British officer whom she despises. And she tries to resist and can't. And the rest of her life then is spent grappling with this thing that she'd been forced with. And she is someone who had, I think she took to heart these notions of a woman's independence, and she really tried to enact it, and it was too early. There wasn't really, society wasn't ready for independent women. So her story ultimately becomes a tragedy. So I'm glad that you hit on that, because I was trying to do that, to show through these people's lives rather than tell you the way freedom works or doesn't work for them.
Right. And it's almost as if the personal examination that Margaret goes through based on the idea of forced marriage that she's reading about or hearing about or seeing in a play, that personal examination is almost a method of your book itself, of history. And again, thinking about the individual's experience through the language in which they are given at the time. And I have to say that this really does sort of open up a logic of writing in history that pushes against sort of the powdered wig figures and a mode of history highlighting the men in power. It cuts against that, even though you actually are writing about men in power. So we have George Washington, we have George Germain. I mean, George Germain in England, very, very high powered, quintessentially powdered wig man, and George Washington, but figures who are men with power, about whom there's been a lot written. Yet nonetheless, I feel like the questions that, say, Margaret is asking, and or Abraham Yates, or even Venture Smith, people who are not as privileged in society at the time, or who work to gain more privilege. Nonetheless, these other men who are powerful you're still presenting as vulnerable.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that comes through. George Washington was the last of these six people who I settled on, and you might say he's the most obvious person of the whole era. And maybe for that reason, I avoided it or didn't see it. But when I did, it all kind of fell into place, because for one thing, he is the one who ends up sort of connecting. He connects with most all of the others. And in addition, it occurred to me that by having a figure at that level, the most famous man in America, and putting him more or less on the same level with all the others, with a slave and a Native American and so on, that was kind of making a statement without having to make it. You know, you're just seeing them all as people going through the basic struggles of life. And the same with George Germain. And the point about the men in the powdered wigs versus everyone else, that in a way speaks to, you know, there's for a long time there have been two kind of competing ways of approaching the American Revolution and what it came from. The kind of great men approach that says it was really these men who met in these rooms and came, you know, developed these great ideas that came from Europe and applied them, and that's where the force of the revolution came from. And the other, the kind of left-wing theory, says no, it's really people in the streets who were building this anger and resentment and this demand for freedom, and that's where it came from. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm not in the academy, and I don't really have a dog in that fight. I think both of those are true, and I guess I thought that by including people from all backgrounds, including the men in the powdered wigs, I was able to kind of have it both ways.
Yeah, in some ways, actually, it almost seems that those choices, say the great man history, and then the sort of people from the everyday, a ground up sort of history, that they're false, that they're almost false choices, because what you show is that, well, what's uniting them is their own individual need for freedom in whatever terms that is for them. And so it's really not one or the other. It's actually about making each person, whether they're in the room with the men or on the streets, a human being. And once you do that, then you begin to feel something much larger through the individual. Because, you know, the way you present George Washington, and I, to be honest with you, I have not read the many, many George Washington biographies, and maybe some of them gesture towards this, but is a very vulnerable man. And so there are these wonderful moments, for example, when he wants to show his worth and value as a leader, as he does early on in the eyes of the British, to get a commission in the army. But then in the eyes of the American leaders of the Continental Congress, he wants to show his worth and value by simply taking a coach and livery instead of riding a horse. And you know, it's easy to put that in a kind of, well, you know, this was important for the time to present himself, blah, 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 blah. But what you have done is to show like how that is a need for him to begin to sort of cover over any sense of insecurity or deal with any sense of insecurity he's feeling. And it's that insecurity that unites him with all these quote unquote everyday people.
And I think that the approach where you're covering the whole life, that allows you to see patterns. So, you know, if you just looked at the coach and livery story, you'd say, okay, well, maybe it meant this or maybe it meant that. But if you see, if you're going through all of his earlier life, you see this pattern of this need to, as a boy, you know, ordering, you know, to his tailor exact specifications for the kind of suit he wants, and the importance that he himself places on the way I look, the way I present myself, and this determination to, and underneath that is this, you know, keen awareness of losing his father and losing opportunities, not being able to go to England and get a proper education. And so then it seems to me you're able to build this life with all of its vulnerabilities and its causes and effects, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you even say early on, I think, that Washington could have felt emasculated. He was certainly taken advantage of economically by the British with his planting, his farm, his plantation. But also what else was going on in the moment, as you say, just pay attention to the life story, but the inability to have children, and that these things must be, I don't even want to say thought together, but they must be felt together. You know, that it's not a private fact and a public fact, but it's a fact that these things are leading to the same feeling of impotence and emasculation.
Yeah. And with Washington, it was, there were those elements where, you know, the realization, what must it have felt like? And this is, his biographers have all grappled with that, this realization that he and his wife couldn't have children, but she had had children with her previous husband. So it was obviously his fault, if you want to look at it in those terms. And putting that together with his, you know, he was a total Anglophile who wanted nothing more than to be given a commission in the British Army. And had they given him that, who knows how history would have turned out.
Right,
But, you know, they wouldn't give it to colonials. So he ends up just being an officer in the Virginia militia and working his way up that way. And then ultimately, of course, siding with the Patriots. And there was a huge economic, I guess you would say, emasculation that the colonists felt. People like Washington all over the colonies and who were being kind of choked financially by the British, by all the strictures they were putting on them one after another. And I think, you know, looking at it from the perspective, then when you switch and look at it from the perspective of George Germain and others in London, you start to realize that it was kind of like one hand didn't necessarily know what the other hand was doing. You know, one group of people was issuing one set of sort of financial decrees about the colonies, and later another group was issuing another, and not seeing the squeeze that this was putting on the colonies, on the colonists. So they're, not to excuse them, but you see how complex that is, but then you see the effects in a particular individual, in someone like Washington.
Right, and it's also just a result of each individual is seeing it from their own perspective, and there is no overall all-embracive perspective, you know, even of the historian. And in some ways it would be dangerous to think that, you know, oh, here comes the historian who could make sense of everything because, you know, he or she sees it all now. But what you do is you say, well, let's maintain the separate perspectives of each individual because that is what leads to the conflicts the sort of contingencies that end up becoming, you know, inevitable events. And so in some ways, it's like a history through the whims of individuals at every level of the system, you know, showing kind of slip and slide into great events. And you have an eye toward sort of contingency and circumstance and personality. So what is your feeling about the sort of, I don't want to say inevitable and great, but those are the words that, you know, people associate with, say, Washington and the result of the revolution. But, you know, so many of these twists and turns in the plot are sort of accidents of time.
Yeah. And I think the important thing to do when you're writing history is try to stay with in the moment, because the people in the moment did not know that it would turn out in a certain way, and therefore Washington would be seen as the father of his country, for example. Someone was just asking me recently about, well, what was something like, what would, you know, who would the people, who would those people be, and what would the things be if you wrote that book right now? So, I mean, about this moment in time. And I don't really know, because we don't, I mean, we can pick six people, say, and write about them right now. And that would be interesting, but history as a, you know, as something that you look back on and see it with a beginning, middle, and an end, has that kind of structure. But we don't know this crazy moment we're living in now, what the structure is, which is why it's so kind of hair-raising to live through. And that was surely the case then. I mean, when you think about it, the people who decided to, from all different backgrounds, who decided, yeah, we're going to fight against England, fight against everything we've known, while the war was going on, they, and this only occurred to me sort of in the middle of this, they had no idea, you know, even if they won and they got everything they wanted, they had no idea what then. I mean, they didn't know, all right, we'll have a constitution eventually, we'll have a president. I mean, they didn't know any of that. All they knew was, okay, we'll fight against them. And, you know, so talk about, you know, just flying off into the unknown. It was really, you just truly don't know what's around the bend. And I try to keep that in mind while I'm writing, and not just, because then it kind of kills the thing if you put that, you know, that blanket of like, Washington will be great, so don't worry about it, if you lay that down over the text.
Right. It makes it easier, as I said at the beginning, for people to identify, people today, readers today, to identify with these, you know, big names, so to speak, and to acknowledge that anything could happen at any moment in the present, that it, nothing is inevitable. You know, it things don't automatically get better or automatically get worse. And so in some ways I felt like it's inspiring to read about people's, you know, the whims and the accidents of people's lives, because it shows that the future is open. The present is open. And so I'm wondering, I guess, how people have, the book has only been out for a short while, but responded, say audiences responded when you talk, or who have read the book, in terms of what they may have thought they knew about this period or these people.
Yeah, the what I'm getting, and it's only now, really, in the past week or so, that I think the book's been out long enough, and it's a pretty big book, that people are coming to events who have read the whole thing, and you know, or rather than just coming to hear me before they've read it, and so I'm starting to hear people react to it as something that you can fall into, and that you're just riding on these waves, and you're being moved from one to the next of these different people in their lives, and you're experiencing this from their different perspectives, this thing building, meaning the founding of a nation, which is, and you know, that seems to be the way people are reacting to it, which is gratifying, because that's what I wanted. I didn't want it, and I think I was trying to kind of take advantage of the fact that people come to it with a little template. They know how it's going to end in you know, one sense. So I don't have to do that. I can, even at the end, I don't have to say, and it all ended happily ever after or anything like that. I just stop when the last one dies, and hope that that loose structure works, because people can bring their own, you know, knowledge or their own structure, mental construct of the period to bear on it.
Right. And it, although it is a long book, it actually reads quite swiftly because of the narrative drive of it. And I think that's one of its great strengths.
And I made this decision early on that I normally, in earlier books, I'll kind of weave in historiography. I'll step back in the middle of the narrative and say, oh, and by the way, you know, we now know this about that person, but at the time they didn't. And I'll, you know, talk it in different levels. But I made a determination that I would just start the thing and we would just stay in story mode. And even things like, you know, how there are things like, for example, Margaret Moncrief, the few people who've written about her in the past, take it as read that she died in 1787, because there were obituaries in London papers announcing her death. I knew that wasn't true, because her memoir comes out in 1794, and it goes right up to 1794. She's still doing things. So these people had said, well, somebody else must have published it, and then they just filled in events or something, which didn't make any sense to me. But I had this theory, you know, why those obituaries, I had these questions, why the obituaries then and what's going on here. And slowly I puzzled out that, you know, I found one, then a second, then a third letter that she'd written after that period into the 1800s. And then I found through several trails, one of which is in the text of the memoir itself, that basically she faked her death because she was building up this mountain of debts in London, faked her death, and then shows up a couple months later in Paris, and her life continues. Now, that backstory about me figuring this out is not in the text. That's in a footnote. So I made this determination that the text is just going to tell the story. And if you know, for those who want that kind of the backstory, that's there as well. That's how I tried to do it.
Yeah. And I noticed that footnote, and as the story was written, as I was reading it, it felt inevitable, or that this something could happen, astounding, but that, okay, it's in line with her life, that she would fake her death and move to Paris. And then later on, I was reading the footnote and I thought, oh, wow, okay, most people haven't assumed it that way. And again, I think it just goes back to what you're saying about listening to a life story and trying to figure out emotionally, you know, the dynamics that are driving it. But I also want to just go back briefly to what you said about not including kind of historiographic summaries in the text. A paragraph, there's a story, then there's a paragraph about, you know, well, at this time, you need to understand that, blah, 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 blah. And that you say, just tell the story, but because of your knowledge and research and reading of the time period, the way you're telling the story and the descriptions of the characters contain the weight of the ideas of the time. So, you know, the historiography appears within, again, how people are trying to articulate themselves. And so it's very clear, you know, ideas are in the air. And at the same time, maybe it doesn't really matter the debates about academic debates in terms of, well, you can understand it this way or that way. If those ambivalences, and you leave it open in so many ways with these characters, if those ambivalences are embedded in the storytelling itself, you know, it also reminds me of the romantic historians of the 19th century. Romantic historian being a sort of general term to describe how history was written in the 19th century and before, with you know, sort of values of good and evil and a kind of moral imperatives. But it was also an example of sort of embedding kind of the characteristics of an age in the characters of the history itself. And I'm just wondering what your influences might be, or if you have an eye towards how history has been written before.
I certainly have an eye toward how history is written in different ways, but I also don't, I don't have a model like I'm going to do this the way Barbara Tuchman did it or something like that. You're right to point out that while what I just said is true, that I've, you know, certain kind of chunks of information or reasoning, my reasoning, I put in footnotes. Other things I weave into the text or try to in a kind of what I hope would be a seamless way, so that, for example, when I'm talking about young George Sackville, as he was for much of his life and then became Lord George Germain, when I'm talking about his education, that's a moment where I can put in a couple of paragraphs about how a young British aristocrat would have learned about the world and England's place in the world and the developing sense of empire. Now, I'm not literally I'm not in the classroom with him at that moment, but I'm using that moment as a little aside to flesh out the worldview of someone like that. So those are ways that you can stay with the character, but still add that.
It would make perfect sense that not only that you gesture towards that at that moment to give us information, but because that's the information that George would have had at the time too. So again, yeah.
That's why I feel you can do it there, because this is the kind of thing, but I'm also not saying this is precisely what
George's character is complicated as every other character is, but he's certainly a very willful, arrogant man. And I was also thinking about some of the portrayals of people who are not your focus, but do appear in the narrative more than more than others, or more than just mentions of other people. And one would be Alexander Hamilton, who sort of comes in towards the end or second half. And so because people associate Hamilton in so many ways in popular culture now with the musical, I'm just wondering how, and Ron Chernow's biography, of course, why you chose to sort of talk about Hamilton in the way you do, which I would admit is a kind of, you present him as a sort of certainly an elitist, but almost like a tyrant in his sort of maneuvering and manipulation.
Hamilton is in there more. Hamilton's in there by association with one or another of my six. That's how most secondary people are in the text. And as it happens, he's closely associated with Washington, of course. So we see him with Washington, but he becomes closely associated with Abraham Yates. And what I try to do is when I'm with one or another of these people, I'm trying to be somewhat sympathetic, seeing the world from their perspective, even with Germain, who's kind of a natural, you know, heavy. He's kind of a natural bad guy just because he's so blustering and such a figure of empire and all of that. When I'm with Yates becomes this, you know, he's from birth, seemingly, he's this anti-elitist man of the people, man of the streets. He's the ninth child of a blacksmith. He's so low in the order that there's not even room at his father's, you know, blacksmith shop for him by the time because he has four older brothers. So he's sent off to apprentice with a shoemaker. So he becomes a shoemaker by trade, and yet he's really smart, and he sees this inequality in the world around him, and he's got this thing against the elites. And so he begins to teach himself the law, and he runs for a low office in city government and starts working his way up. And so he keeps that mentality, that man of the people. After the revolution, he then turns on the revolutionary leaders, in a sense, because they start, in his mind, they start to take on these features of the British elite that they just overthrew. So he represents, in a way, this real class struggle that was going on in the period as well. And he's a New Yorker, and Hamilton is a New Yorker. So while all this is going on, the New York, you know, each state has its group of leaders, and they are maneuvering with each other. And he sees Hamilton as someone who, like him, is very low-born, ought not to have any pretensions to being, you know, a big muckety-muck. And yet he does. And Hamilton, not only that, Hamilton sort of forces himself in front of Yates time and again. Hamilton comes to Albany, which is Yates's territory, marries into the Schuyler family, which is the great aristocratic family, and, you know, basically right in front of Yates, kind of rubbing his nose in it. And so to Yates, Hamilton is just, you know, not content with his station, or not content with being proud of being just a humble person, but has to put on airs. So that's why, you know, I'm giving that perspective of Hamilton, because that was Yates's perspective.
Right. It makes perfect sense from Yates's perspective that Hamilton was, you know, an elitist or a tyrant in regards to Yates's worldview or sense of self. And it also makes me think that, you know, if someone asks, well, yeah, but who was Hamilton really? There's no such thing as any one of these people really, because they're always only in dialogue, conversation, conflict with other people. And so, well, you'd have to say, well, who was Hamilton to Yates in that moment? And then that's what's actually interesting.
And, you know, what I hope you get a little of that dynamic, because earlier you see who Hamilton was to Washington when he was this young officer in Washington's staff, with whom Washington had this complicated relationship, and Washington, I think, had a more naive view of the relationship. He saw Hamilton as this star and this rising star, and he was happy to have him and to use him and his energy and Hamilton, meanwhile, had this burning ambition, and he felt it wasn't being fulfilled under Washington. He was being held back. And that erupts into this kind of famous fight or struggle that they get into, that Washington takes Washington completely unawares. And there's this father-son dynamic between the two of them. So that's a completely different Hamilton that you're getting there, because you're looking at him through somebody else's eyes.
There's no cohesive description of someone over time. And also that this idea that there's a version of someone really is a fiction. Even though we may say with, say, George Germain, that he's kind of like quintessential, you could say, not a nice guy, or we might not align morally with him, but even then, you create great sympathy for him. But I have to say, there's the question of slavery and how it's so easy for people to say today, well, obviously slavery is wrong, and these people were wrong for having slaves. And there's, you know, there's been a lot of work trying to complicate that, you know, how did they see it from their end and all that. So what are your and you gesture towards the question of slavery by saying there was an inconsistency in people's understanding or of the inclusivity of the idea of freedom. What are your thoughts about the prevalence of slavery and the founders and how you wove it and did not weave it into their stories?
Well, that gets to the, you know, at a very, you know, basic sense, slavery is one element of, you know, when the country, when this big messy thing happened and they cobbled this together, this country, you know, things happen in the real world and in real time. And you could write, and people did write, histories in which the end result was this glorious, you know, inevitable, God-given thing, the United States. But in reality, it was cobbled together with a series of internal flaws and inconsistencies that were paved over. And slavery was one of and attitudes toward it was one of those things. And to just say, okay, we're going to march forward and yeah, we've got a little problem here and there with this freedom notion, but, you know, we're marching forward and we're a country. That problem didn't go away, and it has been with us ever since. I mean, the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, what's going on today? I mean, these issues, the fissures in the country today go all the way back to the beginning. And the Civil War, okay, the Union wins. Well, they didn't deal with it. They still didn't deal with it. Reconstruction was just putting Band-Aids on it, and they essentially turned their backs and allowed the South to kind of recreate slavery in all but name, and I think we're still dealing with those deeply problematic things that were there at the founding.
Right, and your gestures to the inconsistencies in people's, you know, ideas of freedom are crucial, I think, to the emotional dynamics as well. So it's not simply to say, well, that has not been dealt with, but not dealing with it was somehow central to people's sense of self. And that the sort of, you just see it with slavery, obviously, as the major example across American history, but also the treatment of any number of oppressed or minority people, indigenous people. But also, you know, in today you see it with class conflict, that there's some, it's not simply, oh, that person hasn't thought about it, or that needs to be taken care of. Well, of course it needs to be thought about and addressed. But that not addressing it is actually crucial to their sense of being in the world. I mean, the idea of a slave, having a slave could shore up your masculinity or your sense of self. And so intellectually, it's a problem. Well, they're enslaved and this other, their master is free. But the free, you know, well, what is it? Edmund Morgan, who wrote American Slavery, American Freedom, a great classic of academic history, that it's slavery that gives us our understanding of freedom very early on, and how one person's freedom was another person's enslavement.
The whole project is, I mean, it, as I say, it happens, these things happen in real time and in a world filled with imperfections, and people choose to, I mean, famously, Lafayette. I mean, there were people who thought they were fighting for freedom, and once they got it, that meant freedom for everybody. And Lafayette famously afterwards says, well, if I had known that I was fighting for a system that would perpetuate slavery, I would never have lifted my sword in it. So people had all different kinds of ideas about what they were doing as well, which gets back to my point about, you know, they were just marching forward into this without really knowing what the outcome was going to be, and then fighting over that. And then you have the whole period under the Articles of Confederation, where they slowly start to come to the next realization, which is we have to, you know, form this federal system, and that's the only way this is going to hold together. But, and that's what, you know, where I first truly came to understand the perspective of the anti-federalists through Yeats, and this notion that, you know, wait a second, Yeats, that he when they went to meet, you know, first they were going to meet in secret, all we're going to do is, you know, fix up this, the Articles of Confederation. He didn't believe it. He said, they're meeting in secret, they're going to try to, you know, foist some new tyrannical federal government on us. And he was, I mean, you could debate the tyrannical part, but he was right about what they were doing. And when he saw a draft of the Constitution, he hated the first three words, we the people. Because, you know, he said, with these group of elite men meeting in secret, they come out of their room and they decide they represent the people. How dare they? You know, so looked at from that perspective, you can see that, and again, this is a thing all through American history, that certain people would say, you do not represent me. You don't speak for me.
Right. And the question also being, why is it for Yeats a problem and not a problem for the people in the room where it happened, so to speak? And I again, to understand it from any individual's perspective changes the terms in which you're calculating what is quote unquote right and wrong. I'm also wondering, as we come to the end of our conversation, about your use of the word song in the title. And I would guess, and I want to hear your thoughts first, that it has something to do with the interweaving of multiple voices.
Yeah, I mentioned it. It probably went right by you, but right in the beginning, I said something about you know, it occurred to me from the beginning that of thinking about this, that this was like these different voices all singing different parts of the same song, and that was one way of referring to the structure, this, which to me, and the whole structure, you know, to go back to where we started, coming up with this idea of people from very different walks of life who by definition are in different places, and trying to, you know, pull their stories together without pulling too hard, without forcing it. I felt like I was kind of going out on a limb in deciding, okay, I'll do that. I'll write such a book. And the whole time I was writing it, I was saying, does this work? Does this work? And I'm still saying, you know, I kind of go up to, you know, people who come to the events to hear me talk about it, who've read the book, and say, well, does it work? Because that's, you know, that song is the thing. That's what I was trying to do. And it was something different from what I've done in other books. And, you know, it's a bit of a risk, but I felt strong enough about it that I thought it was at least worth taking the risk.
Right. And I come back to it because I think it's more complicated than simply saying all these voices are singing the same song, in that there are commonalities, but they hear it differently. They feel it differently. Their parts within the song sit in sort of contrapuntal relationship with others, right? It's not unison. It's not one song that we're all singing, you know, the same exact notes. And I think that is actually the power of the song. I mean, you know, that when you begin to notice people singing different parts that may at one point kind of introduce some disjunction, and then at another point they resolve, and then there's another disharmony, so to speak, and then a resolution. But it's not ever a full resolution, as you say. We're still dealing with a lot of the problems of the revolution. We're still fighting the revolution, so that the song is ongoing. That it's almost singing the song is a trying to get to some ultimate harmony, some ultimate unity that may not actually exist.
I wish I had thought of that. That's a really nice observation. I think there's a lot in that, and it would be wonderful if that's the way people are reading the book, because it's it is truly an ongoing thing, and these voices are not all singing in harmony with each other, and that's the real thing. I mean, that's what history is. History is this confounding, conflicting set of forces and vectors, and it's the job of someone who wants to write a book. You know, the somewhat artificial thing is a book is supposed, strive to be a work of art. And that means having a structure, having a beginning, a middle, and an end, and feeling complete and feeling like it has a sense of closure. But there's a certain artificiality about that too.
Yeah, actually, when you say work of art, it also reminds me another way I was thinking about the book is as a history painting, and you know, these classic American history paintings that depict, say, one battle or the lead up to a battle and the culmination of a battle, but you're seeing multiple moments of that battle in.
Well, the history painting that's on the cover of the book is the one done in 1850, I think, of Washington crossing the Delaware. And that's a total construct. I mean, it has all these, the reason I thought it was kind of fun for the cover is it's got all these different people from different backgrounds, different skin colors and all that, on all striving together in this boat. And the way the publisher did it was they put, normally you see Washington front and center, he's standing in the front of the boat, but here Washington is actually on the back cover. So the others on the front. But that painting is what you're saying. It's not that's not a historically accurate depiction of the event.
Yes, but it attempts at some kind of cohesive fiction. But there are many other American history paintings where you actually see multiple events in the same frame. And I think that's how I take your book as a whole. But that you can't have a perspective that encompasses them all. You can't think for everyone yourself, but you can at any one moment stand within the painting at a particular point in the canvas and feel it to be three-dimensional. And that as soon as you act as if, well, there's only one view and here's how to bring it together, then you're in danger of sort of furthering a fiction, creating a world in your own likeness, which is, you know, sort of a general conflict for many of these characters.
And you have to give, you have to assume a certain level of sophistication on the part of the reader, or in your analogy, the viewer of a painting, that they understand what this painting is doing, and that they're able to kind of work with its storytelling structure. And that's, I think, what I'm doing, and probably what any writer of history is doing too. You're assuming certain things on the reader's part. We're working, this isn't just me, we're doing this together.
Right, and I also have to say that it, you know, reminds me of those opening words of the Iliad, you know, wrath, goddess, sing of Achilles, calamitous wrath, and how songs can you know, sort of be the drivers of stories of men or heroes striving to be gods. But also that music offers us a more complicated understanding of humanity with multiple voices and multiple characters, and the word song contains both ideas, you know, striving with and against each other.
You're the second person in 2 days to refer to the Iliad as the in relation to that word song in the title. So that was that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it before, but there must be some resonance.
Definitely for me. And the art of the book as a whole, I feel resonated for me. And I think that again, it's one of the great strengths as a narrative historian that there's an art to history, and it's intimately connected with making us feel something of the past in the present. And with that, I want to thank Russell Shorto for joining us today. His new book is called American Freedom, I'm sorry, Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. Certainly that was the idea that stuck out to me. Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom, just out from Norton. Russell, again, thank you for your time.
Michael, thank you. It's been a pleasure.